world. Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love. I'm your host, Don Hutchison. Every Tuesday, I interview someone from around the world who's discovered their talents to do work they love to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. On Fridays, I interview an individual with many years of experience from one of the most popular or interesting occupations or professions who shares an insider's look at what it's really like to do what they do. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Mark Dorchman, and our topic, A Day in the Life, What's It Really Like to Be a Community Builder? Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Don.
It is our pleasure. Mark, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Well, I believe I am. I have been using various talents doing the work I love for years and love the way I've been able to integrate sort of my passions with my work.
Excellent. Well, we're going to dive into that whole story because you've had an amazing career on so many levels, and we want to share the details of that with listeners around the world. Just a few words about Mark Dorchman. He's an entrepreneur and community builder who's worked with neighbors, city leaders, and social profits for 30-plus years to help shape Nashville development, revitalizing its most sought-after neighbors. He's founder and chair emeritus of Village Real Estate Services and president of Core Development Services, which activates Nashville's urban center with adaptive reuse and mixed-use infill development. His Village Fund and Core Fund nonprofits have granted millions to organizations helping to enrich and strengthen Nashville. Mark is the author of 1 Mile Radius, Building Community from the Core. He holds degrees in zoology and Spanish and an MBA in international management. Well, Mark, that is a summary of your amazing career. Take just a couple of minutes before we get into the backstory and tell our listeners of any projects that you're working on right now that have you excited and motivated, please.
Well, we've got what we call a BHAG, our big goals for core development right now. And we try to develop it, what we call 1 mile radius communities, meaning that we want to create walkable, livable communities that take the characteristics that are already there, enhance them, and create great experience for merchants and community that live in the area. And so we've got a pretty big project right now. It's the old Memorial Hospital building, and it sits on about 35 acres. It's in outer East Nashville, inner Madison, and it's been vacant for years and years. And so we have it under contract, and we're just starting to think about rezoning to create attainable housing, maybe some makerspace for some of the entrepreneur folks in the neighborhood. We're looking to try to create hopefully some low-cost office space for social profits and basically a whole community. We get to build out to the street and create something that isn't there. So it's pretty exciting.
Gosh, that couldn't be more exciting. How many individual residences do you think you'll be able to build out from the Memorial Hospital?
Well, we have about 550,000 square feet of existing space, and then we have all the acreage around. I don't know. It could end up being 1,000 units when it's all said and done with, 250,000 square feet of office space. And I don't know how much commercial space yet. We're just really digging in and starting to do the master planning. But wow, it's exciting to be at this phase where there's really nothing and we get to create it.
Yes. Gosh, that's just one. How long has that project been in the works?
You just asked me what's current. I mean, I got the contract on it a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, gosh, that's just wonderful. Look forward to hearing more about that. Well, as you know, everyone's life is about turning points or passages from the day we're born till we leave this plane of existence. So take us into the backstory of Mark Dorchman, all the way back to family of origin, and tell us about the people and choices and changes that have gotten you where you are today.
Well, I was a preacher's kid. My dad was a Lutheran preacher when we lived down in Boca Raton, Florida. And preacher's kids are notoriously rebels. So we came from a preacher's family, a lot of preachers in the family. And my cousin's family, they came from preachers too. And when we got together, we would sort of get in trouble and test the boundaries. My uncle and aunt were had taken a congregation in Montgomery, Alabama in the mid-50s. And one of their teachers, Sunday school teachers, was Rosa Parks.
Oh, my word.
And so when she ended up not giving up her seat on the bus, Robert and Jeannie Gretz became part of the civil rights movement and the bus boycott.
What year was that Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat?
This is like 1956, 1957.
Right. That was one of the more historic moments in history.
Yeah. And so their house ended up being bombed twice. They were threatened, put in jail, all sorts of things. And Robert Gretz was known as the white preacher from Montgomery. And unfortunately, both my aunt and uncle both died in 2020, but they had a legacy type of experience, and it certainly influenced me in my life, you know, seeing them be of such service. But as a rebel, I took off when I was 17, and I hitchhiked around the world, really hitchhiked about 20,000 miles, and I picked up a skill as a young man, juggling. It just seemed like a great thing to do.
Forgive me for interrupting. I've never heard of anybody 17 hitting around the world ever. What was the catalyst for that amazingly courageous and adventuresome journey? What got you to do that?
Search for self. I mean, yes. I was in a place where I'd finished high school, and I decided not to go to college immediately. And okay. So I just took off and hitchhiked out first to California and visited my sister. Then I went up to Wyoming and worked for a while. Then I went down to Utah and worked at the ski resort. And then I hitched down to Arizona. I mean, I was just hitching from various places through the country. And then I ended up going to South America and spending some time down in four countries down there. And then later spent some time in Europe. So those were the places where I'd sort of hitch and couch surf and do whatever I could to make a living along the way.
What was the high spot? What were a couple of the high spots of that amazing adventure?
Because I had become a juggler, I ended up, you know, doing some crazy stuff. I ended up doing this gig with some other jugglers in Nicaragua, and we ended up attending a protest in front of the U.S. Embassy. And apparently, one of the gentlemen who was working, you know, to try to help the people of Nicaragua had been killed by Sandinistas, and there was a group of internationalists that were protesting. And when they saw us juggle, they invited us on a journey to walk through the war zone to the place where this guy was killed. And they invited us because that guy was a juggler too. And he had used to help the kids get vaccines and things like that. He'd entice them with juggling to come into the clinic. And so they wanted us there just because of the symbolism. Well, we ended up doing that, and it was crazy to see what was going on in Nicaragua at the time. The Sandinistas had just routed, you know, the Contras out of Nicaragua, and they were having this big meeting with generals, and we ended up on stage doing our performance, you know, performing for 16 generals and all these young soldiers with their machine guns in the square. And I was the interpreter because I speak Spanish. And so I was saying, we're jugglers for peace, and we're going to give you a little show. And I felt like I was Bob Hope, you know, back in the day, but I was entertaining the wrong, not
yes,
the truth, but the
yes.
wrong side.
How amazing was that? Was that stressful?
It was surreal.
Yes.
I mean, it was a perfect, we did a perfect show, and I couldn't believe it because we were so sort of, it was so crazy to be walking and seeing all these bombed out vehicles and shells and results of a war. And then next thing you know, we're visiting the troops and the hospital and doing other little mini shows. It was just bizarre.
Well, I wonder why they allowed you to do that. I mean, you know, so against their modus operandi. Why did they let you do that?
I think they knew that it was a group of internationalists that would have been dangerous. There was about 80 of us on the journey.
Oh, okay.
And for them to come in and create havoc with a group of peacemakers was not a good idea.
Okay. Very pragmatic, right?
I guess so. I was just the clown and the juggler. That's all.
Okay. Wonderful. Tell us some more.
Well, I ended up going back to school, and I got a degree in zoology, and I was working with a marine emphasis up at the Trinity Lab up at Humboldt State University in California. And I got a job working with killer whales and ended up in northern British Columbia, where 150 whales come in each season to feed on salmon. And at the end of my second season, I had a little Zodiac. It was a 12-foot boat with a 35-horsepower Johnson engine. I was packed up leaving and ready to go back, you know, to my truck to go back downtown. And I came upon a super pod of whales going my way. So I slowed everything down and went in their direction. Well, after about 45 minutes, I looked back and my engine had caught on fire. And I pulled off the cover and watched my electrical fry. And the whales went one way and I went the other. Well, I was sort of screwed, but because I didn't have a radio and it was way before cell phones. But I did have a windsurfer on board and I had a sail. And so I figured I had to rig my sail. And for 9 hours, I sailed up the straits, sort of dodging the boats in the shipping lane until I finally landed on a little island. And I was so grateful when I walked into a camp and found two people on the island. And one was this guy with long hair and a long beard and his hippie girlfriend. And I was stuck with him. So over the course of about a week before I got towed off, we became friends. And so that's that story has led me to essentially my career, because a few years later, I was back in Maryland. My father had died and I was helping my mom relocate. And I got a call from that guy, that long-haired guy. And he was down in Nashville, Tennessee. And his father had died, and he was down settling the estate. And this guy invited me to come down, and I got down there in October of 1985, and I never left. Joel Solomon is his name. You said you've interviewed him a few times before.
Oh, yes.
And he and I became not only friends, but we've been sort of partners in all sorts of business ventures since.
Well, what was the value proposition when he asked you to come down to Nashville? What did he propose, or what did you two figure out together?
Nothing.
Okay. All right.
I mean, I came down just to visit, but again, I was in a, I just finished up my master's degree in international business, and I'd almost taken a job in England, and I had another offer to work in Southeast Asia. But when my father died, it threw me off track, and I was sort of casting again. I knew I didn't want to be in Maryland and stay there. Nashville seemed like the best bet at the moment, and so I just stayed. But what I did is I ended up, first of all, doing juggling gigs. That was my first income in Nashville, Tennessee. But after that, I ended up getting a real estate license because Joel's family was in the development world. Mm-hmm. I was going to help them out with some things. And I was working in Hillsborough Village. Joel was part of a streetscape committee, and you know, we were trying to help the merchants find their place because Nashville at the time was sort of a hollow shell of what it is today. We didn't have any housing downtown, and all the urban, you know, ring neighborhoods were, had been sort of voided by the urban flight. You know, a lot of them were vacant buildings, these commercial buildings. So I was helping in Hillsborough Village. And when people asked me what I did, I said, well, I sell real estate within a 1 mile radius of Hillsborough Village. And they said, well, that's what you do. And I was like, yeah, I know that house is coming on the market. And I know that Vanderbilt University, which is across the street, wants people to come live near campus. And I know some of the musicians from Music Row, which is right up the way, is, you know, they like this neighborhood. And if you want, you know, if you're looking for a house near Hillsborough Village, I'm your guy. And it took off. I mean, all of a sudden, that little unique selling proposition took off. And I was selling 27 houses, then 43, then 62, and started growing this practice. And
well, you're not kidding. It's an absolutely beautiful, unique selling proposition. What about it, though? Because you said it was a hollow shell in Hillsborough Village, and the vision sounds great, but not many people see visions very well. So what was it? What was the value proposition that was the catalyst for selling 27, 43, 62 homes? What had you and Joel put together that was so attractive?
Well, I think I was seeing that people were craving walkability and urban, you know, the characteristics of these old houses built in the 20s and 30s. And it was a different proposition than living in the suburbs, you know, where you have, you know, these cul-de-sac homes, et cetera. This was something where you had, you know, a great urban grid, and you had alleyways, and you had the walkable neighborhood commercial district in Hillsborough Village, which we felt like if we could improve this and make it something even better, then will enhance the value proposition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just did a bunch of stuff. I ended up hosting the first neighborhood home tour and Halloween festival. And I don't know, I just felt like I got there at the right place at the right time. And with Vanderbilt and Music Row and all the cool things that were in the neighborhood, we started attracting people back from the suburbs and started finding other people coming from other places that had lived in cities that were maybe a little further along that really wanted that experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I found that a lot of real estate agents were they didn't even know anything about the urban core. You know, they'd get these clients coming in and they'd take them out and sell them a house out in the suburbs. And then I'd get them on the second round. They're like, I don't know why we moved out here. If we had known this was going on, we would have moved, you know, to Hillsborough Village.
Yeah, sure.
But then we did it again.
Did the press? Yeah, yeah. Did the press pick up on it? I mean, I'm sure that, you know, they wanted the inner core of the city to thrive, but did you have good press and public relations and, you know, building your brand?
Yeah, there was a new magazine that came out. It was called the Nashville Scene, and it was a weekly magazine. And they started doing this thing called the Best of Nashville. And they had a category Best Real Estate Agent. And for 9 years running, I won that. So I had become sort of the top agent in the city, and people recognized me as the juggling realtor and the urban realtor. And as so I started a company called Village back in the mid-90s with myself and two agents. And we were trying to change the way real estate was practiced. And we hoped to take what we were doing in Hillsborough Village, which is where we started, and look at all the other ring neighborhoods in the city and see if we come in and enhance the neighborhood commercial districts, just like we did in Hillsborough Village. And then, you know, the premise was eventually we'll get housing downtown again and we'll move downtown. But we started in Hillsborough Village, and then Joel and I started. There was the next neighborhood over to the east was 50% vacant. It's called 12 South Neighborhood Commercial District now. But we looked at that neighborhood and ended up, you know, starting to invest in some of the buildings. And there's 53 commercial buildings. We ended up coming in and buying 11 of them. But we also worked with the Metropolitan Housing Development Authority to organize the neighbors and the merchants that were there, you know, at the time, asking them what is it they wanted. You know, what did they want with their neighborhood? It was sort of a crime district, and there were so many buildings that were just in such terrible shape and vacant. And they said, well, we want more merchants, and we want better sidewalks and lights, and we want to slow down the traffic because people don't stop and shop anymore, and you know, we want a viable commercial district. And so we ended up not trying to make money with a lot of buildings. We'd buy them, we'd clean them up, we might sell them for a dollar if we could find a great merchant who fit the mix that they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And over time, we ended up, you know, you could start seeing the same kind of phenomena with 12 South, like Hillsborough Village. People were starting to come back and fix up some of the houses that were boarded up nearby. And over time, it has really become one of the hottest walkable neighborhoods in the city, you know.
Wow. What was the date that Hillsborough Village started?
We started that in like 94. We bought our first building in 1994.
All right. And then what about 12 South Neighborhood?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hillsborough Village, we started, it was probably 1990.
Okay.
And 12 South is 1994.
Okay. Wow, anyway, you really moved fast on this, and what I think is so admirable is the, you know, the strategic vision that you both put together. You know, that the tactics had to be vital, but your whole vision of improving the whole quality of life in these communities, even if it meant not making much of a profit, in the long run, turned out to be very visionary as well as profitable.
Well, I could say, you know, you look smart after 25 years. But
well, I hear you. That was hard, though. That was really hard to see through that, and you did. Both of you did.
Well, when we bought our first building, we celebrated with some of our friends, and everybody came out and said, "You're crazy.
Yes.
Why are you buying property here?"
Right.
The goal was to try to help re-inhabit the city. Because, again, you had a lot of absentee landlords, you had properties that were in terrible shape, and this is everywhere in Nashville. You know, 12 South was a fairly poor neighborhood. You could get houses in the 40s, 50,000 range back then. East Nashville was another case where we went in and started working with the Five Points neighborhood and sort of, we started that in 1998. There was a big tornado in East Nashville, and it had ripped through and taken down you know, 6,000 trees and damaged thousands and thousands of houses. And that became a catalyst for coming back and rebuilding and, you know, getting the community interested in a visionary process to create what is now a very eclectic and cool, artistic, creative neighborhood. It's really fun. Eventually, the city started shifting. It decided back in the late 90s to start opening up to residential living. We had been called the Central Business District, and for 50 years, we had restricted any residential. And in fact, until really 2004, there were only 10 owned units in the whole Central Business District downtown. So 10 houses owned downtown in a city now that has thousands and thousands. I had gotten involved in helping multifamily residential developers sell their properties because I could see that somebody was going to come back in and have to redo some of these old buildings downtown, that you're going to start seeing some, you know, condos in our city at some point. And so I'd studied, I'd gone back to Vancouver where Joel now lives and studied with Bob Rennie. He was a great salesperson for multifamily residential. And then also went up to Chicago and looked at what they were doing because it might be more like Nashville. And when the residential developers started coming, I ended up starting selling pretty much every project that was produced. And so Village grew alongside of that. We ended up having a lot of agents that were, you know, really good at, you know, selling the new vision if it's a new build, or coming in and selling the vision of an adaptive reuse if it was an old build. Mm-hmm. And we were invited to tour this incredible old building. It was 400,000 square feet in North Nashville in a neighborhood called Germantown. And it was 100% vacant. It was filled with pigeons and, you know, all the lead-based paint just dripping off this great old building that had been built in 1872. And these developers were asking us if we could sell it. And we were like, oh my gosh, we'd love to sell this. We need some lofts here in the city. And this is about 2003. And those developers didn't do the project, but I was obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, if I can get a hold of this building, it's going to be really cool. And I ended up convincing the banks to give me a loan to buy a small section of the building. And the bank only gave me a loan because the current owner was in default. And if he didn't pay his bills, they were going to have to take it back. And so they took a risk on me as a developer. And I started my development company, which is called Core Development Services, by doing 23 lofts, then 27, then 36, then 120, then another 100. And we ended up building out a 351 unit project called the Worth of Mills Lofts.
Oh,
and it
word.
Became an incredible anchor for that neighborhood. And it's now one of the most walkable, interesting neighborhoods in the city.
Wow. That's amazing. That was the 400,000 square foot building in Germantown that was built in 1872.
That's correct. And I talked about Memorial Hospital building earlier. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of Worthen. So I'm pretty excited about it.
My word, just an amazing.
And interesting enough, the Memorial Hospital building is owned by the same gentleman that I bought Worthen from. He was a very wily 73-year-old man back at the time. Now he's 90, and he's surely getting the best of me once again, but it's really fun.
oh, just utterly fascinating. Well, what would you have such a diverse background in this, in an amazing niche. What would you say to people that want to get into your field? I mean, you do so many things, it's hard to put but into the community real estate development, how would you suggest they learn about it and explore it and research it to find out if it's something they want to pursue themselves?
I think there's, you know, people who are in the real estate world. One of the things that we did when we started Village, we ended up giving 5% of the company to the Tides Foundation, which was out in San Francisco. And I had come up, Joel had been one of the founders of something called the Social Venture Network. And it was a group that was sort of committed to use business as a tool for change. And as I was getting into real estate before I started my business, I was attending all these conferences, and it was incredible to see like people like you know, Ben and Jerry's and Anita Roddick at the Body Shop and Gary Hirschberg of Stonyfield Yogurt and things that they're doing with their companies to create change. And so I think it was really a pretty important thing I did when I started Village. I gave 5% to the Village Fund, and we, you know, the premise was as the company grew and we started making distributions to our shareholders that the Village Fund would get its share. But what happened is that then as the agents came to the firm, they came for the, you know, we were giving money to things that had to do with homes, neighborhoods, and communities, and giving to organizations and social profits that help with youth enrichment, arts and environment, greenways, and all sorts of really good causes. And we almost became change makers. You know, we ended up integrating with the community in a way that other agents didn't. You know, I would encourage my agents to be sort of agents of change with those social profits. So they were the face of an organization we were giving to. And, you know, everybody in those organizations buy home too. So all these people really liked the work that we were doing, and they ended up buying and selling homes with us. And so it was sort of a virtuous circle. And so I would say if somebody's getting into the real estate business, you might think of it that way. Just think what you can do for your community and how do you engage in your community and what is it that you do that other people don't do? Because, you know, people will notice it and they want to help people who help them, you know, and help the causes that they care about. So that's sort of been the secret sauce for Village and the Village Fund.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's amazing. So where are you headed personally and professionally?
Well, late 2018, you know, we had grown to 350 agents and staff. And I was, we had this big party and I'd been teaching all my agents how to juggle that year. And so I had like 50 agents who had learned to juggle. And so we had this, we had never done this before, but we had a big party for agents and their families. And we invited 100 of social profits that we had given to, and it was 22 years in business. And so we decided to call it, you know, 22 in review. And we had some professional jugglers who'd come up through my juggling club who were really good. And I've gone downhill. Come in, and they ended up putting sort of a professional show together. They helped us choreograph a little show for the agents that had, you know, had learned that year with me. We decided we wanted to give away enough money to, we had given just under, we had given about $2.1 million through the Village Fund through the years. And we gave away another $100,000 at the party to all these social profits so that we could top off at 2.2 for 22 years.
Wow.
But I was overwhelmed by, you know, being the head of a company with so many people, that was a little bit out of my comfort zone anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'd been trying to figure out how I could give the company away, because I was sort of working with Core Development now. And I have a little sales team called the City Living Group that has independents that sells with the multifamily residential. But the next week, I heard that some of my agents were going to leave and start their own company. And I called one of them and I said, David, what's going on? And he said, well, you know, we want to start our own company. We all came up through Village. We love what you've done, but we want to give it a shot. And I said, well, why don't you buy into Village? And he said, I didn't know that was an option.
Wow.
But long story short, they needed to close in a couple of weeks, and we ended up coming to a deal, and they bought the company in early 2019.
Imagine if you hadn't made that phone call.
Imagine, yeah. If you want to hear the color to it, when I told him he could buy in the Village, you know, they wanted to sit down, and within an hour they said, you know, Mark, we want to buy the majority. And I was like, that's great. We want to buy the buildings that, you know, that house the agents. And I was like, fantastic. And then they said, we need to close fast. And I said, super. But I was leaving the next day, and I was going on a journey with some of my entrepreneur organization friends. And I was on the plane heading out to San Diego when I got the offer. So we're prepared to leave that night. We were jumping on a boat and we were heading out to Guadalupe Island to go diving with the great white sharks. And I needed to sell the company. So we ended up getting a satellite dish and bringing it on board so that I could negotiate the business. And I really negotiated the sale of the company in the 6 days that we were on that journey. So I negotiated by in the evening and then go back and dive with the sharks during the day. And by the time we got back to shore, I had sold the company.
That's one of the great stories of all times.
I had to come out. I had to go out with another fish story because that's how I started.
No, my word. Yeah. My word. That is so amazing. Huh. What do you think your single greatest talent is?
I think I am a community builder, and I think I am able to use sort of the – it's almost like the juggler's tool for lots of balls in the air. Mm-hmm. I'm able to keep a lot of things going in a way that touches the community in a good way that has led to, I think, an enhancement of the city I'm working in over the years.
Yes, yes. Amazing. Mark Dorchman, what a great pleasure being with you today. We so much appreciate you sharing the highlights of your life journey. And I know that listeners around the world have learned so many lessons that will help them on theirs. So how would our listeners get in touch with you? How do they get a copy of your book?
There's a website, onemileradius.com.
Okay.
You can order it on the website.
Oh, okay, okay. Also on Amazon too, right?
Yes, it's Amazon. Yeah.
Good, good.
Or you can find me at markd@villagetn.com.
Excellent. Listeners know you can go to discoveryourtalentpodcast.com and click on podcast in the nav bar, and there you'll find the show notes of this fine interview. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We can't ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive. We thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.